Hi, I'm Grant Hogue from Boston Children's Hospital, and thank you for tuning in to a new episode of the Scoliosis Dialogues. We are now in the second episode of our new format, highlighting articles from current and upcoming editions of the SRS flagship journal, Spine Deformity. Today, the article we're discussing is published in the November edition of Spine Deformity, and it is Indications in Timing of Revision Spine Surgery in Adults After Surgery for Idiopathic Scoliosis. We are very pleased to have both the lead author of this paper as well as the senior author in today for our podcast. Lead author is Dr. Andrew Drick, and the senior author is Dr. Douglas Burton. And so I'd like to start off by thanking both of you for coming. And then maybe getting just a little bit of background, a little biographical information. So tell us a little bit about yourselves and maybe start with Dr. Diedrich.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us on, Dr. Hogue. I'm Andrew Diedrich. I grew up in Salina, Kansas. It's a smaller town in central Kansas. Ended up doing my undergrad in the Northeast at the University of Pennsylvania. Then I went back to Kansas for medical school at University of Kansas, and that's where I met Dr. Burton and started this research project with them. And then this past July, I actually started my orthopedic residency. So I'm now an orthopedic intern at the University of Kansas.
Congrats on that and welcome to the club.
Thanks a lot. Chosen wisely.
All right. And Dr. Burton, let's hear a little bit about you.
Yeah, I'm a native Kansan, and I've been on the faculty at the University of Kansas for 22 years and am currently the chair of orthopedics here at KU.
Excellent. And so let's jump in to this study. And I know, Dr. Diedrich, you started this as a medical student. And so what prompted you to go down this line of reasoning specifically?
Yeah. So, you know, I had always been interested in orthopedic surgery for a long time. And so I was interested in trying to get involved in the department specifically through research. Dr. Burton, I had a few people that suggested I reach out to him to see if he had any, you know, ideas for projects and things like that. And, you know, one of the main reasons I've always been drawn to orthopedics is the patients, you know, always seem to do very well. And the surgeon has a big role to play in that. But also the patients, you know, have a big role to play as well in terms of, you know, how hard they work with physical therapy and things like that. And I think that idiopathic scoliosis is one of those interesting disease processes where this definitely plays a role. I mean, these patients end up with significant improvements in their quality of life in terms of pain, self-image, and confidence. And certainly a lot of that is due to the surgeon and the operation if they need one, but also due to their own hard work. And so, you know, I was really excited to be able to learn more about idiopathic scoliosis and kind of also get my feet wet a little bit with orthopedic research.
Excellent. And so, Dr. Burton, one of the issues sometimes with publishing on a complex topic is then those patients seem to find you and show up at your door. So what drove you to publish on revisions in idiopathic scoliosis patients?
Well, you know, it was because the most of the patients that we see really are doing fine. And it's a small number really that are struggling. And if you look at our numbers, 81 patients had come to see us over this period of time who'd had previous surgery. Most of them were doing all right. And they're sort of checking in and making sure everything's okay. But then there was a handful of them, that were struggling. And what was interesting to me was that some of them were a long ways out from surgery. I mean, not just years, but decades. And in particular, what we had noticed was that we were seeing several patients who were found to have implant malposition, but it wasn't implant malposition that was symptomatic for them right away. And I'd never understood how that could happen. If you have a medial pedicle screw, I would have expected the patient to wake up with pain. And yet I'm seeing patients that are 5-8 years out from surgery that said, you know, I did fine up until a couple of years ago. And then when we do the imaging on them, we find, well, you know, this pedicle screw is a little medial. That might be causing a problem. And that was something that I didn't think would be a problem that over the years I started seeing that not often, but, you know, once a year, once every other year.
Mm-hmm. And so if it's all right, I'd like to give a quick overview of your methodology, the 30-second run. And so you were able to find 81 patients who had had scoliosis surgery prior to the age of 18 and who had long-term follow-up. And then out of those, 18 of the 81 went on to need revision surgery. So 22.2%, which is certainly a much higher rate than what had been published in other papers before. And a lot of that probably is secondary to your ability to have such long-term follow-up.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't think that it would probably be fair to say that that's the rate, just because, you know, because our study design is a little unique because it's cross-sectional. So I didn't actually operate on any of these patients originally. The index surgeries were done all over, you know, all over the United States. Mm-hmm. But so when you look at the studies, and, you know, we talked a little bit about this earlier before we went on, when you start thinking about, well, what's the survivorship from surgery? You know, we looked at that 10 years ago with a very tight group of patients that Mark Asher had operated on between 89 and 2002. And, you know, at 15 years, the survivorship from reoperation, even in that group, was 73%. So, you know, if you start following these patients out long enough, there's going to be more reoperations than you anticipate. Because, and most of them are not occurring in the first 5 years. And when we looked at our group, that's the same thing that we found, is that most of these reoperations were not occurring, you know, in the first 5 years, but most of them are occurring after 5 to 10, even after 15.
Yeah. And so in the results, your table one is really, really telling. And that's kind of the meat of this for me, that you've got this one group of patients who had revision at kind of 10 to 15 years. And just like you said, this is for implant malposition, pseudoarthrosis, or even delayed infection. But then another group of patients who after 20 years or even after 30 years had adjacent segment degeneration, potentially stenosis, or even spondylolisthesis. And the spondies weren't even necessarily just below the construct.
Right.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the kind of the super long-term follow-up, these patients, you know, 25, 30 years out.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you've got some people, you know, we've all seen the patients that, you know, they've got a right thoracic curve, maybe they have AIS surgery, and they have the asymptomatic 5-1 spondy that doesn't need anything, except for maybe 30 years later, that 5-1 spondy becomes symptomatic. So we had a couple of those. But then we also had the patients that, you know, had the Harrington down to 3 or 4 and then developed degeneration below. Some of those, a couple of them had a flat back associated with it, but not necessarily. It wasn't like everybody was a flat back. It's just people, the spine ages. And when you've got 40 years of only 2 or 3 motion segments, after 40 years, those two are going to wear out, and not in everybody, but they will in some people.
And so knowing, you know, what you know from this paper, but then also kind of adding that to your own clinical acumen in ways that you've seen spine surgery change over the years, do you think that the future is probably brighter for us in terms of patients needing long-term revision, either secondary to newer technologies and anchor placement or a better understanding of the sagittal plane?
I think so. I think that when we think about what our principles are, they are that, you know, we want to preserve as many motion segments as possible. And I think that that's as true now as it was, you know, when the first Harrington papers were coming out. The more motion segments we preserve, I think the better they are, the better the sagittal alignment, the better they are, and the more accurate and the stronger our implants are. You know, we didn't have any screw malposition when we were doing Harrington's, but I think that our implant accuracy rate now and certainly going into the future is better than it was during the early years of our experience with pedicle screws.
And so Obviously, you see, I've got my Boston Children's logo on here. Yeah. I operate on children. I operate on adolescents. And if you look at even our best AIS databases, getting as little as 2-year follow-up is so hard, much less 5, 10-year, 20, or 30. And so for me, as somebody who probably is never going to see my patients at 50 years old, what would you consider to be the greatest risk for someone who would need revision as an adult? What's the one thing that I truly need to watch out for or maybe just not do?
Well, I think that anytime you're ending at 3 or 4, you know, that person is going to have a higher rate of revision as, you know, at age 60 than somebody that you're able to do a selective fusion and stop it at 12 or 1. I just think that if you can do that, the patient's going to be better off down the road. But you've got to factor that into if it's a double curve and how balanced are they going to be. And so, you know, ultimately, every patient is just the individual and you've got to do the right thing for them. But I certainly feel better when I see a kid that's got a single right thoracic curve and I can stop at L1. I'm like, this kid is probably never going to need another surgery versus if you've got a big double curve and you're going 3-3 or 4-3, you're like, well, hopefully those three discs are going to hold up for the next 60 years. Cause they're going to live 60, 70 years. If you're operating on them at age 14.
Absolutely. All right. And to maybe switch gears a little bit, Dr. Diedrich. And so you pointed out that you started this when you were a medical student.
Yeah.
And was this the first paper that you've done kind of start to finish and really owned, or did you have a lot of research experience before this?
No, this was the first one. I think it was a good research experience for me to kind of, you know, go from start to finish with it in terms of data collection, statistical analysis, and manuscript writing and things like that.
And so my hope is that there will be medical students and residents watching this. So having taken something from conception to publication, what would you say were the biggest struggles for you, and how would you do it differently next time, just from a, you know, setting up your timeline, your methodology, even data management?
Yeah, I mean, the time limiting factor, of course, is the data collection. It just takes a long time to collect data on these people. You know, follow-up, of course, is hard, I think, especially with this patient population, with so many life transitions and things like that. And certainly that would, I think, be a less of a challenge and other disease processes. In terms of things that I think I would still need to work on and hope to develop as a resident, it would be more the research idea generating process. And as I develop more expertise in orthopedic surgery, I, you know, hope to be somebody who's coming up with research ideas and things like that.
Well, I'd really like to give you a compliment on this manuscript, because the scientific explanations are absolutely fantastic. And scientific writing is not easy. It's not something that comes naturally to most of us. And your ability to articulate the findings in this paper was really fantastic. So congratulations. Thanks. On that.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Hoag. I appreciate that.
And then, so the final thing that I'd like to know is, what comes next? What happens next with this patient cohort? Are we going to follow them out for further and maybe learn a little bit more about how they do in the long term, maybe with patient reported outcomes, or, you know, what's the next plan?
You know, I think that the next iteration of this is really getting to what you described, and that is, how do we follow all these patients longer than just the 1 or 2 years? And so if you look at what's going on in the United States and in the world in terms of registries and data collection and big data, I think that's going to be the next step. I think that anytime you do a study like this, I mean, this is just kind of grinding it out, old school data collection. And you know, you've got talented people like Drew that they suck it up, they put in the time, they get that work done. That's not going to get us the 20,000 patients with, you know, 30-year follow-up that we need to start taking those next steps. So, you know, as I think about it, it's like this broader step. And that's where you know, in the SRS, you know, we're trying to develop our own registry through our app that we're developing, so that we can really start to get bigger data and morph that into sort of a longer term follow up with standardized outcome sets and all that. And you know, that we're years away from that, but you know, like anything else, you know, you're not going to get there until you take the first step.
Oh, and certainly a step worth taking. I think that actually really kind of sums up and closes us out. I don't know that I could add anything more to that or ask any questions that would give us kind of better advice and marching orders to head forward. And so with that, I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to the Scoliosis Dialogues and tell you to stay tuned for more content coming over the next few months. And we hope that you are all enjoying this new session where we go in and we actually talk about the articles.
The Scoliosis Research Society is a nonprofit professional organization made up of physicians and allied health personnel. Their primary focus is on providing continuing medical education to healthcare professionals and on funding and supporting research in spinal deformities. Please visit srs.org for further information.